Welcome back to the Girls Talk Money podcast. Today we brought on Emma DeRosas, who is a real estate agent in Greater Boston, to answer all of your questions about buying a home as a first-time home buyer. I feel like we say this after every episode, but this truly might be one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. We just got off recording with Emma, and I was just telling Erin that I feel like I am 10 times smarter now than I was an hour ago before we started filming. Like, this episode was truly so informative, and I feel so much better about the idea of like buying a home.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was also telling Grace that I feel like I know a lot, or I knew a lot prior to this episode, about the whole like home buying process, because if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you might know that I actually have been through the pre-approval process before. I was considering buying a condo about a year ago instead of moving into an apartment. So I went through that entire process. I worked with a real estate agent. I did all of that, but it didn't click until this episode why I had that knowledge, and that it wouldn't be super intuitive for someone who hasn't been through that to kind of like navigate this whole journey. And I just feel like home buying in general is so overwhelming and turns a lot of people off from the home buying journey because the process is so overwhelming and confusing. So Emma did such a good job of like kind of breaking it down and just making it super approachable. She's our age. Fun fact, she actually was my college roommate when I studied abroad for a semester in Florence. That's like how we knew each other, which is so fun. It's so full circle that we lived together in Europe for a semester, and 4-ish years later, now I'm bringing her onto the podcast to talk about purchasing a home, which is such an adult concept. So it was so fun. We got so much out of this conversation.
It's actually hilarious. It's like a behind the scenes thing, is that I connected with Emma on LinkedIn because we both are in like the greater Boston area, and we're just both entrepreneurs. And then we followed each other on Instagram, and I was like, oh my gosh, like she seems so sweet and so knowledgeable. So I hit the Darren. I was like, we should bring this real estate agent onto the podcast. And he's like, yeah, that's awesome. And literally not until like a couple weeks ago did we realize that this is someone that Erin actually knows. Like, I'm excited about her, and then come to find out it's actually someone that Erin knows too. So yeah, it just kind of felt like a perfect opportunity, and it truly was like such an informative episode. After we got off, we kind of talked a little bit about how it can be so hard if you want to buy a home. You don't want to like waste a real estate agent's time. Like, it can feel like, I know I would feel kind of awkward being like, let me just go ask them a million and one questions to make sure that I'm actually ready to buy a home. But then you know that during that conversation, you might find out that you're not ready to buy a home. And obviously real estate agents, Emma, you know, said this herself, that she still wants you to come and talk to her, right? And like, even if you don't think you might be ready. But this is such a good opportunity to like hear directly from a real estate agent about all like the pressing questions that you have, without, you know, going to someone locally and feeling like a little awkward because you're unsure if you're ready. So this episode truly might be one of my favorites. I think it's going to be like, I think you guys are genuinely going to love listening to it.
Yes, you're going to learn so much. We talk through so many things. Your pressing questions will be answered, but also things you might not have even thought about when it comes to being a first-time home buyer. So let's get right into the episode, because we talked for so much. This episode was so good, and I think you guys are going to love it. Emma, welcome to the Girls Talk Money podcast. We are so excited to have you here. We gave everyone a little bit of an intro into what this episode topic is going to be about, but can you introduce yourself and give us your background and how you got into real estate?
Of course. Thank you so much for the intro. My name is Emma. I mean, I'm sure you guys know I am a real estate agent. I am located in the greater Boston area. First of all, I'm so excited to be here. Love you guys' content. Me and Erin actually studied abroad together, so this is definitely full circle. But in terms of a little synopsis on me, I'm a real estate agent in the greater Boston area, actually on a two-person mother-daughter duo team with my mom, Susan DeRosas. And you can find us at DeRosas Realty Group on all of our socials. But I don't want to say stumbled into real estate, because I was kind of exposed to it from the womb. My mom has been in real estate in Boston for, she doesn't like me to say the exact number, she's like, you're giving away that. But she has been in the greater Boston real estate scene for 38 years. So literally taking me and my sisters to showings and strollers and snuggly is when we couldn't find babysitters. So was always inspired by her hustle, tenacity, everything else. And out of college, didn't really know what I wanted to do. And she essentially was like, low barrier to entry. I know that you can pass the test. Why don't you at least get your license and try it out with me and we can see how it goes. And I was 3.5 years ago. So yeah, we've been definitely combining our generations and different perspectives to reach a larger client base now, but we represent buyers, investors, sellers, developers, and residential real estate transition in all.
Is there a typical demographic, like an age group or something like that, that you tend to work with?
Honestly, we don't say no to anyone, but I will say in between my mom and me, it differs a little bit just because, you know, I bring in a lot of first-time home buyers because that is kind of my demographic. And a lot of my friends that are thinking about buying soon have been talking to me and that type of thing, young investors. Whereas my mom has developed enough clientele within 38 years, obviously, to have more of a consistent, I would say, client base where they bought with her 20 years ago. Now they want to downsize and then buying again with her. So she has a lot of repeat clients in terms of buying and selling, whereas I'm bringing in, you know, clients that are starting their real estate life cycle at this point.
Golly, love that you work with first-time home buyers, because I would say most people listening to this podcast aren't current home buyers, or they would be looking to be a first-time home buyer in the next couple of years. So that's what we want this episode to be more focused on. But you have probably kind of an interesting perspective being in the Massachusetts market, because that's definitely a more expensive market. And I think like our generation in general is just a little overwhelmed by the entire home buying process, because we just generally feel like everything is so expensive now and it's so unattainable to purchase a home as a first-time home buyer. So can you kind of talk us through like what you're seeing in that aspect? Is that true? Is it actually like attainable for a first-time home buyer, and kind of like how do you help people navigate that?
Yeah, for sure. And I will say, like, this is where different perspectives are great with my mom and me and, you know, our small two-person team, because I myself can relate to a lot of first-time home buyers. Like, I want to buy within a year or two. So, like, I'm directly impacted by a lot of the things that first-time home buyers are, and I share the same struggles. Definitely, Greater Boston is a super hyper-local market in terms of intricacies, market trends, pricing, and everything else. I will say it is attainable. And what I always suggest to first-time homebuyers, it kind of sounds cliche, but don't let the fear of striking out keep you from playing the game. Honestly, the headlines can be really daunting, and a lot of people will, without even having a conversation, just feel like I can't do it. It's not for me. And I always suggest, you know, talking with a real estate agent like me, or at least talking with a loan originator. You know, that's why we're here, to these conversations with you, so that at least leaving the conversation, you'll have more action items and feel as though it is more attainable. And I think that growing up, me in general, I've always been interested in real estate, and I would watch, you know, House Hunters International or all of these like HGTV TV shows. And I was always under this impression that I was going to find, you know, my dream house with my dream kitchen, and it would be in the perfect location. And the fact of the matter is, although Boston has more of an inventory shortage, inventory is short of, you know, low levels across the board, across the United States. So it really comes down to also getting real with yourself as a first-time home buyer. You know, you might not find your absolute dream home that checks off every single one of those boxes. And that's honestly a little rare to find that. I would say you hit the jackpot if that's something that you can find anywhere. And it more comes down to talking with your real estate professional about, you know, wants versus needs, what you think that you could compromise on or negotiate on. I've had clients who, you know, started off saying that they would never live outside of Boston, and now they're moving outside of Boston because they're like, okay, the square footage that I can get for the price, and look at this yard in the suburbs, that type of thing. So it really just takes dipping your feet in the water before you dive in. And I'm happy to say that I have helped a lot of first-time homebuyers that, you know, when they first came to me, thought it wasn't possible, but there's a lot of myths and I don't want to say conspiracies, but a lot of headlines that keep people away from starting the process.
I'm curious, you're talking a little bit about the wants and needs, and I love that perspective because as someone who just signed a lease on an apartment in January, that was something even I had to navigate being in Massachusetts, just on like the apartment front of like, all right, what is really a need and what's a want? Like, what can I compromise on? What are some of the things that you see people compromising on? You said like location was one of them in an effort to actually find a home in a really competitive market. Like, I'm curious what that looks like when people come to you with their list of things. What are some of the things they come with versus what are they ending up with?
Yeah, for sure. Also, congratulations on your apartment. I've been following
your
apartment hunting journey, and your place looks really nice and all the designs and everything. I would say probably most common, like I just said, is location. Besides that, it's also, you know, housing types, I would say. Obviously, you have single families and you have condominiums and that type of deal. And I think that, you know, the American dream, a lot of people see themselves buying like a big single family, but the reality is that, you know, condominiums are nice, especially like you don't have to live in a big condominium complex. You can find a three family that's been converted into, you know, three townhomes. And that can give you more of a single family vibe while also having the price of a condo. And then just basically, basically how the house is essentially. So I've had clients that even have made decisions of, do I want a house that is absolutely move-in ready, you know, completely new construction. I don't want to have to do any work. To, okay, maybe I compromise a little bit on that and pick a house that might need a new kitchen. Or it might just be a complete fixer-upper, because when you think about it, new construction is nice, but everything is picked out for you. Besides, if you buy it pre-construction, where you can kind of work with the builder on customizations and specs. But I've definitely had clients now more so interested in controlling more aspects of their home design and renovation, so that essentially they can, you know, make their dream home themselves. Essentially, and with a lower purchase price at that point.
Okay, so when it comes to the purchase price, let's kind of shift gears a little bit here to more of like the costs associated with homeownerships, because I'm sure this is something that you help a lot of first-time home buyers navigate, like how much house they can afford. So I guess like to start, how do you go about talking someone through like this is the purchase price we should be looking at based on maybe your salary or based on how much cash you have for a down payment or things like that? How do you kind of help them like start that process of figuring out what would be a comfortable a comfortable purchase price for them?
Yeah, for sure. I would first off say, you know, definitely speak with a loan originator. I've done a lot of real estate transactions where I can speak on the topic, but in terms of how you enter a transaction, it's two people at first. It's your real estate agent and your loan originator, and they kind of work hand in hand. I mean, the loan originator more so on the finances side, the real estate agent more so, you know, in person, boots on the ground, showing you houses and everything like that. I usually working with the loan originator, we can come up with some sort of a budget. I will say that typical rule of thumb that most lenders will, because first time home buyers are, you know, they're not cash buyers. You are going to have to get a mortgage and a loan. So typically it's your down payment and closing costs saved up, as well as a cushion of 3 months of mortgage payments. That is what people say. And as well, I've had clients follow that. I've had clients that, you know, may be a little more strapped. They might not have 3 months of a cushion. They might have two. So people have to make sacrifices. But in terms of how much you should save, that's typically what we tell clients. And in terms of how much you can afford, based off of my conversations with loan originators as well, they typically follow the 28-36 rule, which basically states that no more of 28% of your monthly income should go towards housing costs. Again, this is a figure that sometimes gets a little compromised depending on your location and other factors. But then Beyond the 20%, it's that you should spend no more than 36% with your housing costs towards payment. So the 28-36 rule is what lenders typically give out to kind of calculate what your loan amount will be. And your loan amount is different than your purchase price, obviously, depending on your down payment. But that's typically what the mechanism that they use along with your debt to income ratio as well.
Okay, so to kind of like recap this to make sure I'm following along, because I haven't heard the 28-36 rule. So let's say just make numbers even. Let's say someone's monthly salary is $10,000, which like is very high. So $10,000, the 28 to 36 would be between $2,800 a month to $3,600 a month for total housing cost.
Yeah, essentially a mathematical equation, like to put that in Y equals MX plus B, basically. Took up your total monthly household income and you can multiply it by 0.28. If that makes sense.
Okay.
Then that should be what would go towards housing. Mm-hmm. And then, but then after that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say, but then after that, that's when you start to consider also the debt to income ratio. So if someone has some other outstanding debts, the loan originator would factor that in as well, because that would be a higher percentage of your overall monthly salary that's going towards debt as a whole.
Exactly. Yeah. So they build on your mortgage payment with your other monthly debts, which, would be credit card payments, student loan payments, car payments, if you have that. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Interesting. So can you talk a little bit about, I think we should have a whole conversation about closing costs, but can we first start with the down payment situation? Because so we asked on Instagram what questions people had, and there were so many people saying do you really need 20% down? Because I feel like that is what freaks people out a lot and stops people from even talking to a real estate agent about what they might be able to afford, because they're you look at the average home price in Massachusetts, it's 500 something thousand the last time I checked, and it's 20% down is a whole heck of a lot of money, especially if you're someone who's buying by yourself. So can you talk a little bit about that? Do you actually need 20% down, and what does that look like as a first time home buyer?
Yeah, for sure. I will say it's probably one of the biggest myths in real estate that you do need 20% down to purchase a home. If you do the math on any of that, that is a lot of money, especially with purchase prices in the greater Boston area. Honestly, really standard and common is 5% down, and then a 95% loan to value type of situation. But FHA goes as low as 3.5%. If you're a veteran, you can get 0%. I've even had some emails lately of banks offering 1%. 20% is definitely not the standard. The only caveat there is that if you put less than 20% down and you are getting a mortgage, your bank will charge you PMI, private mortgage insurance. The ideal situation for a bank is if you put down 20%, they like the 20 to 80 ratio. However, that's not really realistic for a lot of the population. So if you put down less than 20%, banks will say that's fine, but we are going to charge you PMI, which basically will stay in place until you reach your 20%. Or if you do, there's other ways that you can get rid of it before that. Let's say your home has appreciated in value, like you bought it 5 years ago, and if it has appreciated a certain amount that reaches the PMI, you can get rid of your PMI and your monthly payment. Or if you've done significant renovations that also increase the value of the house. So PMI is also on top of your mortgage payment. So it's on top of the principal, interest, taxes, insurance. So, and depending on the amount of PMI, that comes from your loan originator as well, but it can get pretty costly. So that's another reason why some buyers are like, I would rather just wait until I can afford the 20% so that I don't have to pay a PMI. But there's kind of, despite little ways that I just said to, navigate that or get rid of it, it's kind of just something that as a first-time home buyer, if you really do want to buy, you might just have to come to terms with.
Mm-hmm. So for anyone who might not be familiar, PMI stands for private
mortgage insurance, I'm pretty sure. I don't know if you stated that, but just if anyone doesn't know, that's what it stands for. And so the PMI, you said you can get rid of it if you do renovations, the home appreciates in value, anything like that. Do you have to go through the refinancing process at that point to drop the PMI, or kind of like, does it, do you just call your bank and say, can I get rid of this, or how does that work?
Yeah. So usually, I mean, there are a few different ways. So if your home has appreciated in value, you can get a BPO, which is a broker price opinion. I am an agent. My mom is a broker. So my mom has, you know, written BPOs for a lot of our previous clients that want to get rid of their PMI, and you would present that to a lender, and they could, you know, work that into getting that out of your monthly payment. You don't always have to refinance necessarily to do it, but a lot of people do, because just refinancing in general is something beneficial for a lot of buyers, especially with high rates right now, just to, you know, make your monthly payment a little bit more manageable. And I will say that is something else in terms of headlines and everything else, high rates. But, you know, you really only, the rule of thumb in banking as well is after six months, typically you can refinance. So, you know, you might look at a payment, especially with PMI as well, your first one, and be like, whoa, that's a bit alarming. But it is one of those things where you have to think about real estate like any investment as, you know, long term. And after 6 months, you usually can open up the conversation of refinancing to hopefully get more affordable payment.
So with Aaron and I both being self-employed, and then we also have some people listen to the podcast who are self-employed as well, and asked the question of like, what does that look like in terms of down payment and getting approved for a mortgage if you are self-employed? I still want to talk about closing costs, but what does it look like from like the down payment and getting approved for a mortgage side if you're self-employed? Does that change? Mm-hmm. Should you really not put less down? Like, how does that differ?
Yeah, so it is, and I can also speak on this as well, because real estate agents are technically self-employed. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was first getting into the field, I was asking my mom, like, how am I ever going to buy something when you need to pick like that little, like that look at your, like, you know, W-2s and, you know, your monthly income. And, you know, with freelancers, self-employed people like us, you know, our incomes are very fluctuating, so it's not as cookie cutter. They typically take the average income over 2 years, and that is how they calculate it. It's a very common thing, and it's not something that should steer you away at all. Banks service a lot of freelancers, contractors, self-employed people. I will say, you know, it is just like a little extra step for them in terms of, you know, kind of calculating out and averaging your incomes, pre-tax and everything like that. But that's typically what they do, and it's very standard. So no worries there.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay, so then closing costs, because this is something that Aaron and I have talked about when we've talked about, you know, why we have not purchased homes yet. Because I feel like so many people think about the down payment, but then they don't realize that there are closing costs. I know my brother bought a home a couple years ago, and I went on all the tours with him and things, and I was just like shocked at like all of the hidden costs that I just didn't know about, because I had never gone through that process before. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what are closing costs? Like, what are they going towards? Mm-hmm. And how do you predict when you're going into buying a home? How do you know, okay, I have enough for a down payment and closing costs? Like, how do you calculate that? How do you know you have enough?
Yeah, for sure. I will agree that it is I wouldn't say it's like a hidden cost, because it is something that once you actually start seriously looking, you would know about it. But I will say, the down payment is something that is very big on people's minds, that closing costs is often overlooked from a bird's eye view. So closing costs, which also you won't have to estimate that. It won't be, you know, guessing what my closing costs will be, that type of thing. Your loan originator will tell you, as soon as you like get pre-approved or anything like that, your loan originator will tell you, this is what your closing costs will be. So you will know that, and you will be able to factor them in. But closing costs basically represent a lot of a few different things that happen between your offer acceptance and based in like literally the day that you're at the closing table. So attorney fees, you have to, I mean, if you should be represented as a buyer, and the attorney comes in after an offer acceptance. So, yeah, how I said, usually in a real estate transaction, there are two people that usually is your agent and your loan originator. That is the case until you have an offer accepted, and then the real estate attorney comes in to represent you in terms of your purchase and sale and making sure that, you know, you're all set legally, as it is a very big transaction. So attorney fees, appraisal fees. Appraisal fees will also come from your bank. The bank has an appraiser go to the property and make sure that the value is what you offered. So they want to make sure that as they're lending you a lot of money that, you know, this property is sound, it's in a good location. Not that it's in a good location, but just not that it's like falling apart, essentially. And then, you know, things like underwriting fees for actually when you get to your mortgage commitment date. There's also title fees, like the title, which is like your actual ownership in the home. And the lawyers representing you have to, you know, research the title, make sure there are no clouds on the title. But it can get expensive, I agree. And there are not, depending, so this is depending hyper local type of factors, but seller concessions do exist. I know that in a real estate market like Boston, where it is a seller's market and it's rare, but if there's a property that has been on the market for a little bit, and the seller really does want it to sell but hasn't gotten a lot of traction, it is something where you can ask as a buyer, depending on what you want to negotiate on, the seller contributing to your closing costs or offering a concession to help towards closing costs, that type of thing. And that's another thing that can be talked about in terms of a buyer consultation and your wants versus needs, because there are deals to be found. It might not be a super hot single family home that has over 80 people at the open house and, you know, there's 12 offers. The seller isn't going to give a concession for that, obviously, because they're going to have a lot of people that don't need concessions or want request that. But that being said, it is something that can be found for the right houses or the right deals. Developers will sometimes do this for new construction projects. They'll offer either a buy down program or concessions towards closing costs. Yeah.
Okay, so when it comes to closing costs, for context, I've gotten pre-approved for a mortgage before I moved into my apartment last year. I went through the pre-approval process because I was considering purchasing a condo. And the closing costs were what got me and like definitely steered me away from wanting to make that purchase, because just like to run the numbers, I think the purchase price on the condo was $130,000. So like very, very affordable. You're definitely not going to find that in Boston. But I'm in Pittsburgh, so it's a lot.
You might get a shed.
It's a lot more shed. So I was going to put 20% down. So that was what, like, I can't run the numbers on my head. But then on top of that, the loan originator quoted me $11,000 for closing costs. And that just seemed like so crazy to me on a $130,000 purchase. And then I was like, what if I was purchasing like the median home price of $300,000 or whatever? Does that triple, or like, would it not triple? Because $30,000 would be absolutely insane.
So it is, I mean, it's dependent on a lot of things, but it does correlate to your purchase price. It's not like set. How much it correlates really depends on the market location and like your actual mortgage plan with your bank. But it does tend to go up if the purchase price does go up. And it's one of those things where you kind of have to wiggle around it, or as I said, find, you know, that might be able to give a seller concession, because in terms of how to find your way around that, it's tough from a real estate agent's perspective, because it honestly doesn't have a lot to do with us and our services. It's more the bank and your lawyer and those types of services. So it is tough, but seller concessions are real and they do exist. Like I had a client who literally a few weeks ago, property was on the market for 3 months, and the seller said that they would for closing credit, which is totally normal, and it did help them a lot. So
okay, that's so interesting and very good to know. But I guess that kind of
brings us to the topic of like, when is buying better than renting and when is renting better than buying? I heard this tip one time on, I think it was like the Bigger Pockets Money podcast or something, where they were saying that since closing costs can be kind of considered more of a sunk cost, like it's really hard to recoup those costs when you go and sell the property. They were suggesting like, if you're not going to stay in the property for less, or if you're going to stay in the property for less than 5 years, then you're probably not going to make your money back on the closing costs or something like that. Like, do you have a good rule of thumb for when someone should maybe consider still renting if they're not planning on staying in the property for X amount of time, or if they want more flexibility or things like that?
Yeah, for sure. Actually, love as well. I have heard the 5-year rule. I think 5-year rule is good to go off of. I'm not one of those real estate agents who will be like, oh, this is how much you've spent on rent in 5 years, and like this much equity you could get if like you put that towards, you know, actually buying a home. And the fact of the matter is that can work for some people. However, it really depends on your finances. Like if your down payment is going to drain your savings, but you can't afford it, I wouldn't tell you to do that, no matter how much you are spending on rent. So it's very personal, and I would never push someone to buy versus rent unless, you know, it really works for them. I will say, depending on location, renting might make more sense. However, where I am right now, rents are very, very, very high. And rents are obviously up across the country as well. But when you're really comparing the, you know, especially rent increases per year, it might make more sense to buy, but I always use the 5-year rule as well. If you, you know, don't really know where you're going to be in 2 to 3 years, you might move, jobs up in the air, that type of thing. You might relocate. I wouldn't suggest it. I am a, you know, greater Boston native. I went to school in Massachusetts. I love Massachusetts. Work here. My whole family's here. I don't plan on ever leaving. So for me, and you know, with price appreciation and everything else, for me, it makes sense to try to buy as fast as possible. But yeah, with closing costs and everything else, I will agree is kind of like a sunk cost, because when you think about your down payment that's going towards your home, and you know, your home is appreciating in value and you're building your wealth and your equity, whereas closing costs are kind of just fees that you have to pay for. So would agree that it is a sunk cost, and it is hard to recoup that if you are moving, you know, in less than 5 years. Unless you are like a very serious real estate investor where, you know, you do like the buy a house 2 years, you know, flip it and, you know, continue the cycle. But for most first time home buyers, that's, yeah, not the case. So
this is so fun. Like, I'm learning so much. Like I said, I went through the process with my brother when he bought a condo, but I just went on like, I just did the fun stuff where I went on like the tours, and I was like, no, not this house. Or, you know, like I was, cause I'm really like detail oriented, and he's not. He would just walk in and look around and be like, nice. And I'd be like, no, look at the floorboards. Look at the, you know, like I was really like detail oriented with it. And I saw like that side of it, but I didn't see the kind of behind the scenes or the beginning stage of when he kind of started his journey. So can you talk about like, so someone decides, or let's say someone decides that they do want to buy, it makes sense for them, and they come to you as a real estate agent and they're like, okay, I want to buy. Like, what are the initial things? Like, what does the beginning part of the process look like? Like, what questions are you asking them? What information do they need to give you? Like, how does that all start? And how long does the process usually look from like, okay, initial contact to like buying a house?
Yeah, for sure. I would say as soon as someone comes to me, the first question that I will ask is if they are pre-approved, because I would want to talk to their loan originator, you know, start to develop that working relationship. If they're not pre-approved, it's not like I'm going to be like, okay, bye. I will, you know, keep having a, you know, initial buyer consultation type call to understand more of their wants and needs, location, that type of thing. But I will definitely open the door in terms of, in order for us to really get down to your exact budget, we are going to need to bring in a loan originator to, you know, really look at your finances to help guide us through this. And if they don't have a loan originator in mind, I mean, that's also the great thing about working in an experienced team and everything else, your connections within the real estate market are really important as an agent. We have loan originators that we work with. Typically, I'll give my clients, if they don't have a loan originator on hand, I'll give them at least 4 or 5 that we work with. And I always tell them, you know, look around, because loan, or like your loan payment isn't more so, I would say, personal and in terms like it is with a real estate agent. Like, you want to get along with your real estate agent and that type of thing. You know, we're paid a set amount anyway. Whereas in loan origination, it's like, depending on the bank and everything else, you could have a very different loan origination. Like, you could have a very different payment with one bank versus another. So I always say, you know, look around, find the best payment that works for you. And once you have that pre-approval, we will then, you know, have a more in-depth buyer consultation about, because price kind of leads a lot in terms of where you're looking, you know, schools, if it's a family, that type of thing. So after that, and then it's like a typical, I would say, traditional buyer consultation where we're talking about your wants and needs. And then after that, it is, you know, sending you up on MLS, which is Master Listing Services, and we will match your criteria, which is how many bedrooms do you want? Is outdoor space necessary? Is parking necessary? Location, picking a bunch of towns and cities that you could see yourself in. And then you will get automatic listing updates that match your criteria every day. But beyond that, it is also on me and my mom's duty at that point, leveraging our connections within the real estate community to look for off-market deals, pre-market deals, things that might be coming soon. Seller doesn't know if they're selling, but maybe we could get you in there for a showing, that type of thing. So really, just like traditional consultation, but also leveraging relationships within the community to find you the best deal.
So when it comes to the search, like the finding of deals and stuff, you mentioned like the MLS and things like that, and pre-market deals, I think is what you said, and off-market deals. How do you know when you're looking for a real estate agent? Like, is that standard that they should be doing all those things? How do you make sure that you're finding a real estate agent that's going to look for those deals for you? You know, like, how do you know?
Yeah, I would say it kind of is like a vetting of the experience. And I don't want to say this as like, I am a younger real estate agent as well, but I am with my mom, who has been in real estate for 38 years or so. So I mean, you definitely can work with someone that is just starting out and everything. It also depends on the brokerage you're with. So I am with Coldwell Banker, which is the leading brokerage in New England, and it's a global brokerage as well. We're able to utilize connections within our brokerage to basically benefit our clients as well. So what does that look like? That looks like me emailing all of the Coldwell Banker agents in Boston and saying, hey, I have a client need with this. I'm not really finding anything on MLS. Do you know any sellers that might be selling soon that match this? Some agents like to work for smaller brokerages. I've found that honestly, just the sheer amount of agents that are in my brokerage and the fact that it is global has just helped tremendously in terms of what we can offer for our clients, as inventory is short.
If someone is starting this process and they're looking for an agent, what do those initial steps look like in terms of like, do they just Google search like agents near me? I think when I toured the condo, it was just the listing agent on Zillow. Like, I saw the condo on Zillow and there was a little agent listed below, and I just pressed like request tour and an agent popped up. And that's kind of how it worked, but I'm sure that's not like the most efficient way to do it.
Yeah, for sure. I would say, I mean, in general, we, like me and my mom run, I would say mostly 75% referral business, just word of mouth recommendations. And so I would honestly, first and foremost, as well as obviously researching, ask family and friends, if you have family and friends in the area that have done this before, because if they've had a great experience, chances are you will too. They're not going to recommend you someone that they had a terrible experience with. I do the same, and not for real estate, obviously, but different services. I will, you know, go to Google. I just always have to remind myself in terms of CEOs and everything else, how much someone pays in advertising doesn't automatically equal experience and expertise and everything like that. So we always go with, you know, family and friends, word of mouth, as well as, you know, combining that with your research as well. I will say a lot of people do, especially with Zillow and third-party sites now, do typically just contact the listing agent. Just keep in mind with that, it does bring in a potential dual agency situation where the listing agent is representing the seller and the buyer at the same time. Not saying that that is a problem. It does work. We've done it sometimes, but also just keep in mind that you could have someone that is solely representing you because the listing agent was working with the seller first in terms of putting her on the market and the thing. And it's your agent as well. Now they will try to represent both of you guys to the best of their ability, but sometimes things can get sticky and sometimes people want someone that is representing them and only them.
Very briefly, just going back a little bit, can you talk a little bit about what an off-market deal or a pre-market deal means and why that is like why that's considered like a deal? Because we had a lot of people ask questions about like, what are some good ways to actually find a good deal? Some good ways to like find those homes that maybe are, you know, more in budget or are a better opportunity than those ones that you were talking about that have like 80 people at the open house and, you know, so many offers going in.
Yeah, for sure. An off-market deal is just, it won't reach MLS. So it won't reach the actual master listing services in terms of putting it out there to the world. And there are a lot of benefits to a seller to doing off-market. I mean, putting your home on the market is, as I said, you're putting it out to the world. Some people are more private and they don't want 80 people in their home. They would rather, you know, especially depending on the type of house, location, everything else, you could do off-market and it could go very quick. Whereas when you put it on market, you know, you're kind of entitled to the open house schedule sometimes and other people's schedules and that type of thing. So off-market is, I mean, there are different, my mom is part of an exclusive off-market listing service where agents will post, will be solely off-market. This is the property. Here are some photos. It will be limited information. Whereas in MLS, you know, you have to follow this criteria in terms of matching the public record, everything else, square footage, that type of thing. Where off-market, you could really just be like, this is the address, let me know if you want to come see it, that type of thing. But it definitely offers benefits to the buyer in terms of less competition for the most part, as it's not something that will be sent to thousands and thousands of people. It will reach a smaller market, so that way maybe hopefully you aren't competing. That being said, some off-market things are pre-market, like you said, Grace, where it will originally be listed off market, but there will be a little caveat in terms of we are posting this to MLS at the end of the month, but we wanted to, you know, pre-show it to people. So that also helps in terms of the buyer's timeline, just because with competition, things can move very, very quickly in a stressful way. And let's say it's Midsummer Standard in the Boston market for a house to come on the market on Thursday, for them to have open houses Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then an offer deadline on Monday. Yeah, and that is, especially if you're competing, you have to talk very fast in terms of, are you waiving any contingencies? What does that look like? Are you going over budget? Can you go over budget? How much can you go over budget? And how will that affect your monthly payment? These are all conversations that can stress people out, even on no timeline, but on a time crunch, it's very, very stressful. Whereas, you know, off market, especially if you have a month of pre-market type of data, it allows you to conceptualize things and, you know, make sense of your own time.
So last question before we get into some of our like more rapid fire Q&A, because we have been chatting for a while, which is so fun, but
can you talk a little bit about the whole like waiving contingencies thing? Because I think that's another big reason why young people are getting super discouraged from the home buying process, because they go to make an offer and either someone comes in so over asking or someone comes in and is like, I'm willing to waive all the inspections and nothing needs to be done, and or I'm gonna pay like all of those contingencies that like protects the buyer in a lot of instances are being waived, and people feel like they can't compete with that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So the standard three-part contingency is your home inspection, your mortgage contingency, and your pest inspection, at least in Massachusetts. Pest inspection and home inspection kind of go hand in hand. It can get a little bit more in-depth if you do a five-part contingency plan, which also will also include lead paint and radon inspections. Any home built prior to 1978 in Massachusetts needs to be tested for lead paint. But you can choose to have a more in-depth inspection as a buyer. But the standard one is the three-part one. And I will say, in terms of your must-haves and non-negotiables, I've had a lot of buyers that do not want to waive their home inspection, and I understand I wouldn't want to waive my home inspection either. And we can't, I would never recommend a buyer waiving their home inspection. I would never say you should do it or you shouldn't do it. It really is something that is a decision for the buyer. But that being said, yeah, depending on competition and things, there will be people that will be waiving them. There are over 10 offers. You might, there might be other people competing against you that will waive a home inspection. But that also goes in terms of, I've had clients that have won with keeping their contingencies. You know, it is all about the team that you keep around you, because and the seller's preferences as well. Sometimes, you know, the seller might want the max price or whatever, but there also could be different preferences in terms of seller would like to, you know, stay in the property for a month after closing or something like that, or an extended closing or that type of thing. And you can make your terms more attractive to a seller without waiving a contingency. And that also goes into what I was saying before in terms of leveraging your, as a real estate agent, leveraging my connections within the field to make my clients' terms attractive so that their offer is still compelling while keeping their non-negotiables in place. And what does that look like? That looks like, you know, having a good attorney on hand that I know will be able to get my client into purchase and sale literally 3 days first. And that also looks like knowing a home inspector that can get in the house literally 24 hours for acceptance. So making these windows within your due diligence period tighter and smaller is also attractive to a seller, but that also depends on, you know, making sure you have a real estate agent that is experienced and that can get these people in there so that your non-negotiables can stay in place. And as I said, it also depends on your location and things like that. There are areas where you can keep your home inspection no problem. I mean, maybe not downtown Boston or, you know, a really hot suburb like Lexington or something like that. But if a house has been on the market for a little bit, you can keep your home inspection, no problem. And we can even maybe talk about closing cost concession, that type of thing. But if you want to keep your home inspection, I don't want that to scare people away, because it is a thing where there are other, the offer just isn't just your contingency page. There's other things in there to make you stand out as well.
So it's all very fascinating. Yeah, like I'm truly like learning so much. So before we wrap up, we want to do like a little rapid fire Q&A, because we got a lot of questions from people and we want to try to get to like as many as possible. So the first one is, we have some people who are actually interested in becoming real estate agents, and they were curious, like, what are some quick tips that you have for them if they want to start the real estate journey?
Yeah, for sure. But I would say, like, as I said earlier, the barrier to entry here is pretty low. I used Freedom Trail Realty School, and they were great. 40 hours of instruction, and while you take That being said, my realty school was great in terms of their on-demand content, their practice tests, that type of thing. I found that a lot of their practice tests were very similar to the actual exam, which was important for me. But yeah, I think it was around $300 or something, but you sign up with the realty school, do the hours of instruction, and then you can sign up for the actual exam.
That's like way cheaper than I thought it would be. I don't know why I thought it would be.
Yeah, so much. Yes. And then, I mean, you just have to think about, as I said, what brokerage you want to join, that type of thing. And also, I'm sure you gals can relate to this, just like planning out your finances, because they're, you know, maybe months where you don't, maybe you're not paying off. You know, the average real estate transaction is 30 to 60 days. So you typically, unless you do get to a pace where you have closings every other week, but there could be, you know, lapses in your payments.
Okay.
Huh. How do real estate agents get paid?
Real estate agents, I mean, it is a little, it could be changing this year, but it typically standard is the seller pays the real estate fees for both the buyer's agent and the seller's agent. And in Massachusetts, the standard is 5%, sometimes 4%. But that is a cost that is paid for by the seller at closing. And then it is split equally between seller agent, buyer agent.
Oh, okay. Do you want to ask the next one, Erin?
Yes. Maybe not, but do you have any knowledge on some of the best markets for young people, like first-time home buyers that maybe you want to purchase in? Because I know you talk a lot about Massachusetts, but it's a very expensive market. So any knowledge or any tools to help people find the current best markets for buying a home?
Yeah, for sure. I know you mentioned this, Erin. I love Bigger Pockets as well. They have great data in terms of what statistics to look for in terms of investing and things like that, and how that correlates to different geographical areas. Boston is very expensive. I will say, in terms of investments, I mean, the purchase price is high, but we just have, you know, the best education, healthcare. We're a major biotech hub as well. There's a lot of reasons to invest here because a lot of talent moves here, a lot of international students move here. So I would say it is a good place to invest despite the high purchase prices. But I think I've seen Austin, Texas is a good one. Charlotte, North Carolina is a good one. You want to look at where, you know, rentability is good and limited vacancies on that same note. You also want to look at taxes. Taxes are also very high in Massachusetts, property taxes, which is not great for investors from an investment standpoint. So rentability, taxes, location, is it in a safe area? Are there schools around? That type of thing. And there are a few other factors, but those are the three that come to mind. And there's a lot of data.
What was your most exciting sale? Like, do you have one that stands out that you were just like a hell yeah, I just did that kind of moment?
Honestly, I would say, literally my first year of real estate, it was, I don't want to, like, sales is, I mean, it is about, obviously, your experience and your tenacity and everything else, but sometimes things really do just fall into place. I'm sure you guys can agree. But my first year, my mom and I had a sale in Beacon Hill, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful property. I'm not sure if you've been in Beacon Hill or Hurricane, but is like just, it has like one of the oldest streets in America called Acorn Street, and it is just like cobblestone brown stones, like beautiful, beautiful properties. And yeah, one of our, he stumbled, we had a different listing in Beacon Hill, and we came to our open house. And this is also something that real estate agents, where they find a lot of deals, honestly, open houses. If a buyer comes in and is like, after walking through, yeah, this house isn't for me, but I actually am looking and I'm underrepresented. That could be a way in terms of lead generation. And that's exactly what happened to us. We were listing one property in Beacon Hill. A buyer came in and he didn't like that one, but he wanted to look elsewhere with us. I mean, obviously we had more conversations about our experience and, you know, kind of interviews and stuff like that. But he ended up buying elsewhere in Beacon Hill. It was a single family home. I think like 6 bedrooms, roof deck. And it was just like my first really, really, I would say like multi-million-dollar sale where I was walking through and I like literally felt like I was in Sunny Sunset, but Sunny Boston. Like, this is beautiful in terms of the actual property and the location and everything.
I love that. Well, our last question, I think you might have mentioned this at the beginning, but we want to make sure everyone can find you. If you are in Massachusetts and you're looking for a home, or you might potentially be looking for a home in the coming years, where can people find you if they want to learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find us on Instagram at Jerusis Realty Group. As I said, me and my mom blend our generations. I'm the social media manager, so I will see your message and I will see your request. Besides that, I mean, just my email is emma.jerosis@cbrealty. And we have a Facebook page with the same social as well, Jerosis Realty Group. And important with real estate is always be responsive. So literally reach out to me anytime, even if you have even like the slightest of questions, I would be happy to talk to you.
Love it. We will link all of that in the show notes as well. But thank you so much for coming on to the Girls Talk Money podcast. This was such an amazing episode. We really appreciate it. And everyone go check out Emma if you might be potentially looking for a home in the near future.